Down in number tonight, they thought I could get this down to a size we could work with, and it's working. But we've got some sick, and Teresa White sprained the ankle that she's had so much trouble with, and so I know that's why David's not here tonight, but might keep them in your prayers. An old Texas rancher had a pair of boots made, and they turned out to be too tight. And so the bootmakers just insisted on stretching them some so they would be more comfortable. But the rancher said, no, I don't want to do that. And then he went on to explain. He said, there's little in my life that is pleasurable. Every morning when I get out of bed, I have to go corral the cows that busted out during the night and then fix fence before I can even get my day hardly started. And all day long, I watch as the strong winds just blow my ranch away. And after supper, you can tell he's real positive. And after supper, I listen to the TV tell about the high price of feed and the low price paid for cattle. And all the while, my wife is nagging me to move back to town. And so when I get ready for bed every night, I want to look forward to the only pleasure I'll have all day, pulling my boots off that are killing my feet because they're too tight. The fact is, very few of us would put up with a life where there was absolutely no pleasure. Just think about the place that takes in our life, pleasure takes in our lives. There's always been some pleasure in between. I remember my grandparents playing dominoes. Stories and jokes and songs. Now, today we understand that for many, pleasure has become the entire goal for their life. Today, folks expect their daily work to be pleasurable, much more than our ancestors did. And so in these days, if it's not fun, most folks don't really want much to do with it. They're looking for some pleasurable things. Think about the time and money invested in pleasure today. In his book, Gods at War, Kyle Edelman wrote this. He said, people spend trillions of dollars each year trying to make themselves happy, whether it's with food or with various forms of entertainment, media, with travel, with drugs and alcohol, or with one of the countless other items that promise to turn your frown upside down. Now, some may disagree and exclaim that they are busier than ever, but the question is, what are they busy doing? Often, they're seeking the money, the resources needed to chase pleasure. And listen, if you don't have much pleasure in your life, most folks look at it this way. If you don't have much pleasure in life, you know enough to know you want some more. And so off we go in quest for the elusive narcotic of pleasure. We're in our third series of lessons entitled Idolatry is the Issue. And I've shared with you that I read a really good series of lessons by David Owens, who preaches at the Church of Christ in Liverpool, New York. He pointed me to a couple of books I read, Counterfeit Gods by Timothy Keller and Gods at War by Kyle Edelman. These guys do a good job relating the concepts of idolatry to our lives today. In the last lesson, we took a close look at God demanding that Abraham make a choice with Isaac. Go to the mountain and sacrifice it. Isaac could become a counterfeit God for Abraham, his reason for living, his solution to everything, instead of Jehovah God. And so God forced him to decide. An idol is anything that takes the rightful place of Jehovah God in our lives. And tonight, we're going to take a challenging look at something that is a wonderful, wonderful blessing. It's pleasurable. But it can become a counterfeit God. It's the wonderful blessing of food. Now, think for a minute about the role that food plays in our lives. I looked at one statistic from 2015 that this one said that Americans spent $208 billion that year on fast food. Then I found another study for 2023. The average American individually spends $1,200 a year on fast food alone. I don't know if that's accurate. Probably depends on where you live. But this study showed that the results were that an average American household spent about 10% of their income on fast food. And that adds up to $110 billion, which could solve world hunger for a few years. That survey of 2,000 Americans found that snacks aren't the only thing that drive respondents to extreme. I had to chuckle at this. 16% said they would shave their head for a lifetime supply of chocolate. I'd do that. But I ain't got much hair to cut off. But think about that, 16%. According to the American Center for Disease Control, 68% of Americans are overweight. One-third of Americans are obese. The average American consumes 2 to 3 pounds of sugar per week. Per week. Remember how much sugar's in soda pop. 100 years ago, when heart disease and cancer were not common, the average person consumed 5 pounds of sugar per year. Interesting. Now, the God of food is an equal opportunity God. You can be skinny and look totally fit and still be a worshiper of this counterfeit God. And food can also be a God if you're consumed with diet and exercise. Food can still be your God. You can even be a vegan. I liked what one rancher said. He said, "I'm a vegan. Cows eat grass and I eat the cows." But you can be a vegan, you can be a total health nut while bowing to this pagan god. Now, we need to remember, first off, that food is good. Everybody agree with that? Food is good. It's not evil. In the Bible, food is mostly treated as a gift from God. God created us with bodies that require food for nourishment and survival. He could have created us in a way where the fueling process of our bodies would have nothing pleasurable about it. But God clearly wants eating to be an enjoyable activity. So he gives us foods with a vast spectrum of flavors and textures. After the flood, God told Noah and his family, Genesis 9:3, "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I've given you all things, even as the green herbs." And so now God expands and says, you can eat everything. He gave us 10,000 taste buds for a reason, to fully enjoy those flavors. And so eating is meant to be a blessing. But the problem is that every gift of God can be twisted and distorted into a lure to pull us away from Him. Every good thing has that potential. Now, let's just stop and think about the way the pagan god of food works. Think about walking into one of our modern restaurants. And as you do so, as you think about that, don't forget that millions of dollars are spent to design and to market these eateries. First of all, that menu in an upscale restaurant is really not designed with nutrition in mind. It's designed with satisfaction. The menu is all about throwing a big party for your taste buds as you eat. When you experience all the pleasure this food will bring, then you'll walk out with everything right in your life, or at least as long as the meal lasts. That's the approach. In fact, watch for the eternal references for food. This cake is heavenly, right? This pie is to die for. You'll think you died and went to heaven when you eat this. Let's admit it. Great food is a true pleasure to consume. Now, again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with enjoying a wonderful meal wherever you eat it. The problem begins when you start to look at food from the wrong perspective. When we start to look for food to do for us what God alone should do. Instead of turning to God, how often do we deal with our troubles as if they were a growling stomach? Adelman wrote this. He said, "When the going gets tough, the tough get chewing." Another man wrote, "A very large part of mankind's ills and of the world's misery is due to the rampant practice of trying to feed the soul with the body's food. And so we eat to find comfort." Again, food is not evil. But the desire for food can lead to making it a counterfeit god. Philippians chapter 3, verse 18. This is really interesting. Paul writes, Philippians 3:18, "For many walk, of whom I have told you often." He's preached this sermon many times. "Many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly." Now think about that. "Whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things." That's an ugly picture of people who live for the pleasure of fulfilling appetites. The last phrase of that passage is sobering and revealing. Did you notice? What are they thinking about? What are they thinking about? When your belly is your God, there's only one place where you can set your mind: on earthly things. They set their mind on earthly things. Now let me show you a contrast to that. Colossians 3 verses 1 and 2. "If then you were raised with Christ," Colossians 3:1, if then you were raised with Christ, "seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth." Tell me what you're continually thinking about, and then you will know to where you're setting your mind. What is your greatest desire? That's where you'll set your mind. And so you can give yourself over to food. Some people look to the God of food to give themselves a feeling of control. I thought this was really an interesting point. Succumbing to the desire to overeat may be a way that people demonstrate power and control. Life can be so complicated and is filled with so many unmet desires and disappointments. We can't control others and make them what we want them to do, but we learn that we can have control over us, over food. We're going to show that chocolate pie who's boss. I'm in control of this. And interesting enough, that the opposite problem of under-eating, anorexia, can have the same root desire to demonstrate power and control. The anorexic person starves themselves as a way to prove that they're in control. Now, secondly, some people look to the God of food to give themselves an escape or a distraction from reality. A constant stream of pleasure-eating sensations can cover up our troubles. You ever eat when you're stressed? You're in really good company if you do. And so we can do that. It can at least keep more troubling thoughts at bay. Especially those thoughts when we're doing self-examination. I mean, a box of chocolates is more pleasant than self-assessment or self-improvement. One minister said, when people ask me why God seems so distant, I ask them, how much junk food you've been eating lately? And how much time have you been spending watching TV? Now, we could add in today's times, how much time have you spent on your smartphone on social media? And the list goes on and on. That's why you feel distant from God. Food can be an escape and sometimes a temporary soothing balm for what hurts. Thirdly, some people use food to give them isolation and protection. For some, compulsive eating is linked to desire to just get big because they're afraid of being thin and being small. They may have been abused in their youth or even later. And being thin is equated with being an object of sexual attraction, which they're trying to avoid. For others, getting bigger gives them the feeling of power so that they can protect themselves. We all need the sense that life is not out of control. Or we need comfort from our fears and our pains. We need a sense of protection and safety. But where we're going to look to find those needs, the fulfillment of those needs? Well, there's all kinds of counterfeit gods, even food, that offers or tempts us to meet those needs. But we have to learn to look to, of course, Jehovah God. Turn to John 6. There we find Jesus dealing with people's desire to eat. We're all familiar with the time Jesus fed the 5,000. It was a massive crowd. And it was 5,000 men. That wasn't counting the women and children, which probably would be more than 5,000. It had been a long day and they were all far from home and they needed to be fed. And so you remember Jesus miraculously fed them with a young boy's lunch basket, with 5 little barley loaves, that would be the poor man's bread. And a couple of little small fish, like a sardine, he fed those people. And everyone ate all they wanted, and they gathered up the leftovers, and there's 12 apostles, so guess how many baskets of leftovers there are? 12 baskets. And Jesus is going to use this miracle to teach a number of lessons, but especially he wanted them to understand that their souls need fed more than their stomachs. He wanted them to learn to hunger and thirst for righteousness. He wanted them to understand what he had taught in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6:25. Is not life more than food? After everyone had eaten their fill, Jesus made his way to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. And the next morning, the crowds were hungry. They started looking for him. They were ready for breakfast. And eventually they found him on the other side of the lake, and Jesus confounded them with this truth. John 6:26. Jesus answered them and said, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him." They responded by asking, "What shall we do that we may work the works of God?" And Jesus said, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him who he sent." In other words, you need to believe in me. Not as your personal golden corral, but as your Savior. And amazingly, they then ask, "Well, what sign are you going to perform so that we can believe?" And if Jesus didn't perform a sign, maybe he could give out some nice fresh bread and fish. In verse 35, Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." A lot of lessons there. But Jesus is explaining that he is the real nourishment, spiritual nourishment they need. You and I need, of course, to understand the same thing. Ask yourself, do I really believe that Jesus is the bread of life and that my real hunger and thirst can only be satisfied by him? Have we learned and experienced Jesus' promise? "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." Matthew 5 verse 6. Have we taken the psalmist up on his challenge, Psalm 34:8, "Taste and see that the Lord is good"? He wasn't talking about literal food. He's talking about spiritual nourishment. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Do you understand what Jesus said when Satan tried to tempt him? Well, he didn't try. He did tempt him. And Jesus responded, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God." Have we come to have the mindset that Jesus had when he said, this is John 4, verses 32, and then verse 34. But verse 32, John 4:32, "I have food to eat of which you do not know." And then verse 34, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work." And so all of that challenges us as the counterfeit God of food, taking your attention away from the real God who is the bread of life. All of that is there. Eidelman makes this point. Idols are defeated not by being removed, but by being replaced. He continued, the God of food promised us a feast, but we came up empty. He invited us to consume until it consumed our lives. We tasted everything until nothing had taste anymore. And so finally we came to Jesus. We discovered that he offers the one true feast. He fills our every need. Every hunger ultimately leads back to him. Nothing tastes better than the joy and satisfaction of knowing Christ. You know, that's so common to us that sometimes we forget the reality of it. Because we don't have to live apart from him. We live with him. Nothing nourishes the soul like Jesus. Nothing feeds and strengthens and renews us like the time we spend with him daily. Have you found yourself growing spiritually as you the Bible, read it more than 24, as you read that daily, those daily Bible readings? Of course. He bids us to take and eat. He bids us to come to the well where he offers living water. You never thirst again. Think of a time when you've come in from the hot sun, you're just drenched with sweat, your throat is so dry, and you drink a big old glass of cool water. I don't know about you, but I don't want an ice cold glass of water when I'm like that. I want cool water. Nothing satisfies more than cool water. And spiritually, that's what Christ wants to be for us. For us to wake up and realize how much we need him and to let him take care of our hunger and thirst. But first, you've got to realize that you're spiritually hungry and you're spiritually thirsty, which means you have to understand it's time to replace the counterfeit gods, right? But there he is, waiting. What a blessing to allow God, through Christ, to supply every need, real need, in our life. If you need to come tonight, please come now while we stand and sing.